Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was down to business this week in Washington with a new president running the store and a gusher of new priorities. Yesterday, President Obama unfurled a jam-packed budget blueprint, saying we'll have to spend before we save.
While we must add to our deficits in the short term to provide immediate relief to families and get our economy moving, it is only by restoring fiscal discipline over the long run that we can produce sustained growth and shared prosperity.
Tuesday night, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal carried the torch of opposition.
Democratic leaders say their legislation will grow the economy. What it will do is grow the government, increase our taxes down the line, and saddle future generations with debt.
And the week opened with stocks swooning again.
Worries about the effects of the deepening recession send stocks to levels not seen since 1997. Concerns about the health of big banks continue to worry investors, and the Dow lost about 251 points yesterday.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to run with Obama's big picture, his big plans, or not? And what do you make of the blueprints? With us this week from Washington is Liz Halloran, Washington correspondent for NPR.org. Liz, great to have you back.
Hello, Tom. Happy to be with you.
And from Washington, Clive Crook, columnist for the National Journal, senior editor at The Atlantic, and a commentator for the Financial Times. Clive, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Liz, and Clive.
Let's dive straight in here. Clive Crook, how do you characterize the scale of, ambitions laid on the table by President Obama this week?
I think it's incredibly bold, no question about that. He's done things that I think a lot of people thought he might slide away from when it came to preparing the budget, especially on health care reform. This huge down payment, $635 billion down payment on the cost of comprehensive reform, I think that's pretty startling.
And that's just one of the very big numbers in this blueprint. Liz Halloran, there's so much here. How do you see Washington, Democrats, Republicans taking this on board? We've got, this is big as it gets.
It's true, Tom. One economist said to me yesterday that the president is not only tackling an unprecedented economic crisis, but he's also trying to roll out a version of the Great Society and all at once. And as Clive said, the most striking element was this health care coverage plan. I mean, the plan isn't fleshed out yet, and that's where the battle likely will be largely on the Hill to determine what health care reform means.
Jack, we'll get into the details, but here's a president saying, all right, I was elected, I'm from a different party, I've got a different vision, my hand's on the wheel now, and I'm turning the wheel. What's he turning toward, Jack?
He's turning it toward a new deal for the American people. Just as the New Deal was a response to the long-neglected problems of industrialization, chiefly the problems of what to do in old age, unemployment and the like, so this is a response to the problems of post-industrial society, the increasing inequality we've seen in our society, the centrality of education in this new society and how that has to be improved, and above all, the healthcare insecurity, which seems to just have grown and grown and grown ever since Bill Clinton's attempt to reform it. And then above all, the environmental challenge that defines the legacy of industrialization, our fouled environment and our imperiled planet. And this document really begins massive strides forward on all these fronts, a new deal.
Obama is saying he wants to be candid. He wants to be much more honest than Americans have become accustomed to in recent years about the budget. Here he is talking about that yesterday.
For too long, our budget has not told the whole truth about how precious tax dollars are spent. Large sums have been left off the books, including the true cost of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that kind of dishonest accounting is not how you run your family budgets at home. It's not how your government should run its budgets either. We need to be honest with ourselves about what costs are being racked up, because that's how we'll come to grips with the hard choices that lie ahead. And there are some hard choices that lie ahead.
That theme all week, reckoning hard choices, but also right from Tuesday before the joint session through the week, The "We can do it, we will do it" message from this president. Liz Halloran, what about this issue of candor and honesty, openness? Where do you see new honesty in this budget, and where are there still maybe some shadows here?
Well, largely the new honesty that he's mainly talking about is the fact that he is going to reflect in his budget the costs of the wars that the nation is involved in, which were not reflected. They were always – the president in past years has come back to Congress for a special supplemental for the war. And so those costs are actually reflected in the budget. And I think it's interesting that you're talking about this this sort of day of reckoning speech, because he had been criticized for being too dire, speaking in too dire terms about the state of the country. And I think he did attempt to reassure people Tuesday night, you know, sort of giving them that astringent message of responsibility, change, and sacrifice, but also what some people call this this mythic America can do, you know, in this together type of message that also served as a preview and a softening for what was going to come in his budget the next day.
The country hungry for that, can do, has done again and again. Clive, do you see a workable blueprint here? I mean, it's the pieces are so large, it's kind of hard to take it all on board. But does it add up to you?
Well, I don't think it does add up all that persuasively, though the administration's honest about the gaps that are in there. You know, the provision for this health care reform is less than half of what the administration says it expects universal health care to cost. So this colossal number, $635 billion, is half or maybe even less than half of what they'll eventually have to find. And then the other thing is that the budget plans, even 10 years out, when we're back to full employment and the economy is racing along again, that there'll still be a deficit of 3% of GDP. That's huge. That's a big number for an economy that's growing quickly and has full employment. So a lot. The bottom line is a lot of extra tax increases or spending cuts are going to be required to balance the books. The administration admits that, but the budget doesn't actually go through the exercise of finding out where those revenues and spending cuts are going to come from. All that remains to be done.
Not everything spelled out here, but Jack, a new complexion emerging here. I mean, tax cuts for the middle class and right on up into 200 plus thousand for 250 plus. Tax hikes, and not just tax hikes, but closing down itemized deductions across the board, a more aggressive attitude toward those higher income earners on the tax front. I mean, is this Obama's America emerging from this pile of numbers, Jack? More focused on the middle class, in fact, not just in campaign rhetoric.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the Wall Street Journal on its front page today calls it trickle up. Well, that's the reverse of what we had under Mr. Reagan, trickle down. And trickle down has brought us pretty much, I think, to this pass. That is to say, a society of really exploding inequality, where the differences between the rich and the rest have just grown. And, you know, now thoughts can be entertained that just a few years ago would have seemed rampant heresy. For example, John Maynard Keynes's idea that tax rates on the rich actually should be kept as high as possible, because otherwise they save too much money and consumption and demand suffers. So that it's actually good to have higher taxes on the rich. And, of course, we saw that during the Clinton years, that a slightly higher rate on the top earners was not only compatible with economic growth, it may have enabled it. So I think in all these ways, this budget turns upside down the dogmas that have really become common sense, or seem to, ever since Ronald Reagan said government is the problem.
Jack, Liz, Clive, let's hear what our listeners have to say about it. Matthew, in Detroit, you're on the air, Matthew.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think?
Well, I applaud, I think, in general, the direction of this budget. I think over the past 30 years or so, starting with Reagan, including Clinton, we've sort of handed the keys of the economy over to the wealthy, and I think they've totally failed miserably in managing the country. So I'm glad to see that there's a trend now toward, I think, a more just and equitable budget and running of the government. My concern is that I don't think it's anywhere near radical enough, given the problems we face. And I would differ with some of the characterization of this sort of new honesty. Just two examples.
Mm-hmm.
Our unemployment rate is much more if you look at the BLS statistics, it's closer to 13 or 14% poverty. We're measuring poverty in the same way we did in the 1960s. A realistic poverty level for a family of four is between $30,000 and $40,000 a year. So I'd just like to ask your guests to comment on those things. I would just hope that, or I wish that the program, the budget, would be a bit more radical.
Matthew, thanks for your call from Detroit. Liz Halloran, I mean, compared to the, what, you know, now we look back on the Bush years and the way things were off books and obfuscated and wars not accounted for, you have to say it does feel like a breath of fresh air to have the candor of putting stuff out there. But there may be more candor waiting here for Americans, maybe more than they can or want to take on board, Liz.
True. I was speaking with a woman who works for an organization here that is a budget deficit hawk organization. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she was actually quite complimentary about the budget and how it did provide a pretty honest look at what was going on. But I think what the caller might be referring to on the unemployment numbers is there's quite a large percentage of people who are underemployed, who are counted in different ways, and perhaps
or those who have given up looking.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think maybe that's what he suggests is true, that there are more people who are either discouraged lookers or underemployed who could be reflected more accurately maybe in some of these projections.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. President Obama lays out his plans. Stocks stumble, U.S. troops pointed home. From Iraq, Liz Halloran is with us, Washington correspondent for NPR.org. Clive Crook is here from Washington, writes for The Atlantic, The National Journal, and The Financial Times. Our own Jack Beatty is here. President Obama was steadfast in reminding the country that a lot of tough numbers were inherited here.
Having inherited a trillion-dollar deficit, it will take a long time for us to close. We need to focus on what we need to move the economy forward, not on what's nice to have. And that's why on Monday I held a fiscal summit to come up with a plan to put us on a more sustainable path. And that is why, as we develop a full budget that will come out this spring, we're going to go through our books page by page, line by line, to eliminate waste and inefficiency.
A lot of debt and deficit inherited here, page by page, line by line, says the president. We'll look at that. Let's get a call from Houston, Texas, and Neil. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
One thing I just wanted to say is that I've been listening to you in New York for a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and I just wanted to call up and just tell you how fantastic I think you are as a talk show host.
Oh, you're too kind. How about the president, President Obama, Neil?
I've never had the chance to call before.
Thank you.
The thing I'm more interested in, well, to begin with, is that the reason I have my job right now is because my company received some TARP money.
Mm-hmm.
And so, obviously, I am one of the people who already has been bailed out. And I hear some of these people complain about that the only way that we're ever going to get things done, you know, listening to what Bobby Jindal speaks, the only way we're going to get things done is to have capital gains tax cuts and all sorts of other cuts. And I realize you make millions of dollars a year working for NPR. But, you know, realistically, I think the reason you're probably not investing in the stock market today is not that you're worried about paying a 15% capital gains tax. It's you're worried that might go down or that you don't even have any money to do it. And I just don't understand why people don't call out the Republicans who are claiming that tax cuts are the solution to everything and ask any of them, would you work any harder if I cut your capital gains tax rate from 15% to 10%, or if I cut your income tax from 35% to 32%, and are you saying that you were working less hard a couple years ago when the tax rate was a couple points higher before the Bush tax cuts?
Neil, those are great questions. Let us pick it up. The whole issue of taxes, who pays what, incentives, and what will really get the economy back in gear. Of course, we had Bobby Jindal talking this week after President Obama's speech on Tuesday. He walked out into the foyer of the governor's mansion there in Louisiana, said Republicans have a different philosophy about how to respond to problems. Let's listen.
In the end, it comes down to an honest and fundamental disagreement about the proper role of government. We oppose the National Democratic view that says the way to strengthen our country is to increase dependence on government. We believe the way to strengthen our country is to restrain spending in Washington, to empower individuals and small businesses to grow our economy and to create jobs.
Okay, there's Jindal on Tuesday night, Governor Jindal, after President Obama Clive Crook, Neil puts it on the table. Jack laid it out earlier. I mean, there's maybe a fundamental shift in political philosophy, economic philosophy afoot here. It did sound a little cheeky for Governor Jindal talking about restraint in spending when we know what the deficits are that just came out of this last half dozen years. And we know that at the end of those years, we've got all of the problems in our lap that we've got there. Do you feel the country ready to make this shift? Is it made already, Clive, away from the sort of ruling political economic outlook of the last several decades? Are people lining up behind Obama, in your view, in a new direction?
Well, they seem to be. Of course, it'll be very interesting to see whether attitudes change as the full implications of what Obama is proposing sink in. Of course, I thought Jindal's response was unimpressive, to put it mildly. He got the tone wrong. The delivery was dreadful. But, you know, the points he was making are not without merit. There are some trade-offs here. You can't keep raising tax rates on the rich indefinitely without seeing some effect on incentives, without seeing some dampening effect on growth. We're going to find out just, you know, where that trade-off begins to bite. But as I said before, you know, my main worry about the budget is that there's so much more tax revenue is going to be required than Obama indicates in this budget. And what he's laid down is a kind of agenda that says we'll ask the richest 5% to pay for everything. I mean, there's no concession to the view that the costs of universal health care need to be shared by a wider group. Everything at the moment is piled on the richest 5%. And if he applies that philosophy to all the future tax revenue increases he's going to have to find, then I think the trade-off will begin to bite back.
Jack, what do you think? We've talked a lot, and people have watched for years as wealth moved toward that richest 5% and 1%. Is there enough there to move back the other direction and take care of all these priorities, or do you see a risk of, you know, the golden goose being in trouble at some point?
I'm not worried about the golden goose. I am worried, though, about the necessity, it seems to me, eventually, of tax cuts, general tax cuts for tax increases for everyone. You can't make these advances without paying for them, and especially at a time when the baby boom generation is retiring and the demands on Medicare and Social Security are going to grow. We have to have more responsible talk on taxation. I think, though, that's going to have to wait for another election cycle. And you already hear people talking about a value-added tax as perhaps one way to deal with the combination of the new programs and the fiscal overhang from the Bush years. But, you know, there is an offstage actor here, and that's the one that worries me, and that's our Chinese bankers, the people who essentially own us these days. Mm-hmm. We lost our economic independence in the Bush years, and they are off there watching. And in Clive's newspaper, I read, they're becoming restive. They're beginning to doubt whether they're going to get paid back. They're beginning to worry that Americans are going to inflate our way out of our problems, therefore cheapening their debt. And they're beginning to think maybe we should take our money and just spend it here. And so
that is Obama, in China.
In China. Mm-hmm. So Obama has to walk a very careful line here. On the one hand, he's got to talk and act to build the future that he sees and to deal with the progressive constituency in the Democratic Party. On the other hand, he doesn't have to worry about the Republicans. He has to worry about our bankers. And if they think we're going to be profligate, that we're really not going to be serious about the deficit, then that could create a tremendous financial crisis for this country. That's what I'm worried about. They are the offstage actors here, and the budget is not honest about them and their influence and power over our future.
Clive Crook, the Chinese punch bowl whisked away?
I think it's a real risk. I agree with what Jack said about that. I think it's why it's very important to, as they firm up the budget plans, that they firm up the fiscal consolidation side of it. That is to say, you know, that they show that they've thought through how to get the deficit down once the recovery is in place. But this is very difficult, especially to do. And it's especially difficult to do it in the framework of, you know, conventional budget planning, because they don't know how quickly they will be able to get the deficit down, because that depends to such an extent on the pace of the recovery. You know, the budget has some very optimistic economic assumptions in it. One of my problems with the budget is that if the economy grows as fast as they say it's going to, starting, you know, actually starting at the end of this year, then they ought to be able to get the deficit down much, much lower than they're saying in the budget. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, we can't get the banking sector problems resolved and the recession lasts and lasts, mm-hmm. then it would be a mistake even to try to get the deficit down that quickly. So mm-hmm. I do think there's a problem there about the credibility of these long-term fiscal numbers. But Jack's absolutely right. In the background, you've got this need for enormous foreign borrowing, and the foreign lenders are going to start asking, you know, is this actually still a safe investment? And, you know, they won't do it year after year, that's for sure.
Liz, I want to get you on how this adds up, but let's listen for just a second here to Fed Chair Ben Bernanke before the Senate Banking Committee this week, saying the recession could end later this year.
If actions taken by the administration, the Congress, and the Federal Reserve are successful in restoring some measure of financial stability, and only if that is the case, in my view, there is a reasonable prospect that the current recession will end in 2009 and that 2010 will be a year of recovery.
Wouldn't that be nice? And then, of course, today we get these numbers out saying 6.2 GDP loss in the last quarter of last year. Liz, one of the things that President Obama spoke a couple of times about this week was the $2 trillion in savings, as he put it, that his administration already has its eye on. That would help. But where are those, and what are those, Liz?
Well, to go back a little bit to what Clive was talking about, all these optimistic assumptions, and I'm not sure you can call them savings at this point. They are assuming a significant economic pickup in the coming year. They're assuming big savings from the Iraq troop withdrawal, although that assumes that the costs in Afghanistan aren't going to skyrocket.
And keeping 50,000 troops there through 2011, we're told. Now, that's not
exactly
free either.
And also, you know, allowing the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy to expire. And then they're also looking at a pot of money from this cap-and-trade emission credits program. Mm-hmm. So they're all very optimistic.
And the $2 trillion, so it's got all those in there. And the Iraq, what is it, like $140 billion or something they're looking to pull out of there per year or something like that, Liz? That's a lot. That's a lot. But 50,000, President Obama at Camp Lejeune today talking about withdrawal plans there. And withdrawal doesn't mean everybody, Liz, from what
it
we can see, by a long shot.
No, he wants to withdraw about 100,000 combat troops by August 31st, 2010. Now, that's about 3 months beyond the limit that he had suggested when he was campaigning, but I don't think anyone's
close
quibbling
enough
over that. Yeah, close enough. And even Senator John McCain has supported this, but he's got his own Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, saying why so many? She would like that halved, and so he's got some issues there. And
why so many left behind?
Left behind, exactly. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Yes. Mm-hmm. So why leave so many behind? And so she's already. And Harry Reid is in somewhat the same boat as Nancy Pelosi on this issue.
Mm. Let's get a call from Cary, North Carolina, down where the president will be today. Mark, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Pleasure, and I appreciate you taking my call.
You bet.
I really love your show.
Thank you.
I listen to it every single day. So
bless
thanks
you
for taking my call.
Yeah.
A couple quick points, and I guess I'll take comments off air.
Mm-hmm.
The first point is this is going to be a really tough political fight to get this budget through, even somewhat intact, you know. And I can tell you that here, you know, I worked on the Obama campaign. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of trust in him as a president. I think it's very refreshing how candid, honest, and articulate he is being with us. That is such a refreshing thing, particularly seeing McCain in some interviews over the past few days thinking, my goodness, what if we had had that for 4 years? It would have been tough.
I have to say right there, I agree. Just the tone and the openness, it may not be complete, but it makes you want to say hot diggity. I mean, you can argue over the details, but just the tone and candor is sure refreshing.
I can say, though, that we're still organized. The campaign, the grassroots organization that formed around the campaign, we're getting emails. We're meeting at each other's house. We're talking to people about this. We're distributing literature, and we'll get more of that information to come. So I think that in itself, the organizational structure that has remained in place for this political fight, and this budget is going to be a huge, huge undertaking to get this through. We're very organized, and we're very excited to, you know, participate at a citizen level to do what we can to kind of get the message out there, to debunk, half truths and so forth, and just get the stuff out there. And the next comment I'd love to hear your guest speak to are middle class wages. They've taken a pounding and have been stagnant pretty much for the past maybe 25 years. They really have not gone up, and I hope there's something in the budget or something within this administration that is kind of promoted that really pushes middle class wages, whether it be through organization or so forth.
And Mark, we'll look at that. Our time's growing short here before the break. We'll look at that. Of course, growth does wonders for that, but we saw in these recent years, as you point out, growth is not enough. Liz, first to the political fight. Mark sees a big one coming in Congress over this budget. We saw what happened with the stimulus bill.
You cannot underestimate the battle that's going to play out in Congress. The president will issue his final proposal in April, and then they'll battle on through the fall on this issue. And he'll have a battle with Republicans. He'll have a battle with Democrats over some of the provisions. There are subsidy cuts that agribusiness is going to fight. The president wants to get rid of some old weapons system. And like I mentioned before, there's going to be a huge battle over the meaning of health care reform. The president has to pick his battles. Mm-hmm. He's got lots of work to do in putting together coalitions issue by issue. And then, of course, there's this earmarks battle that's sort of playing out on the Hill now, too, and how that will all be reconciled before the final budget is signed.
Let me just ask you on the numbers. Are there enough Democrats on board that the majority, Democratic majority in the House, do you think ultimately can just push this through? And then what about the Senate? They had zero on the stimulus in the House, three in the Senate. They have to have some Republicans there. What are we hearing? Is it the same three? Can they count on them in the end?
It's unclear right now because this is basically what the president did yesterday is he released an outline of goals. And some dollars attached to it and some projections 10 years out. But the details are going to be hashed out on the Hill, and there'll be deal-making just like there was with the stimulus. I assume that they're working with the same senators who they think will be amenable to some of the arguments for this. But they really have a lot of work to do.
Jack, what do you see on the numbers on the Hill?
There's a huge test of democracy coming up. Will special interests triumph over the clear public interest here? The lobbies are already working from coal, farm, oil, banking, hedge funders, drug. They're all spending money. And some of the money, by the way, for the banks is money we're supplying to lobby against the public interest. And the president, I think, is going to have to call on Mark and people like him to keep the pressure on these Congress people who, after all, are still elected on the on our corrupt system of campaign finance. And so long as that's there, this ambitious program, I think, is in peril. And on the wages, that question, mm-hmm. I think there is something in here, or there is something coming up, and that is the Employee Free Choice Act, kind of an Orwellian verbiage for a fairer field for labor to organize. 50% of Americans want to join labor unions. They can't, and one of the reasons is the way they are currently elections are held
at
workplaces. They have to vote. And card check would make that a good deal easier for unions and help to raise wages for average Americans. And by the way, the appointment this week of Hilda Solis as Secretary of Labor, I think, is the greatest single cabinet appointment in my lifetime.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. President Obama lays out his plan. Stocks stumble. U.S. troops pointed home from Iraq. Sports heroes up and down this week. And little Stevie, all grown up in the White House, Alex Rodriguez, was announced and booed at the plate for the Yankees exhibition season opener.
Alex Rodriguez.
And then he hit a home run. Tiger Woods teed up this week after 8 months out for knee surgery.
No, I miss that rush of playing and competing.
Preparing with Tiger on one, his tee shot, first professional shot since he won the U.S. Open last year.
Yeah, but his swing's not back yet. He was out in the second round of his comeback tourney, and Stevie Wonder performed at the White House as he received the George Gershwin Prize and thanks from the Obamas.
Even she loves.
There's Stevie and the Obamas. Tears in their eyes. They danced to Stevie, they said. Clive Crook is here from the Financial Times, National Journal, and The Atlantic. Liz Halloran of NPR.org and our own Jack Beatty. Let's get a call from Wendy in Omaha, Nebraska. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Wendy?
Well, I just was listening, and I wanted to comment that I support President Obama 100%. I'm really dismayed that the Republican leadership, if you want to call them that, you know, sounds so shocked about the budget and everything, but this is what he campaigned for and why we voted for him, that he was going to, you know, spend some money on education, infrastructure, and the electrical grid, and how exciting for high-speed rail. So, it's, you know, we had 8 years of the high benefits for the wealthy, and look where it got us. So, during the Clinton years, I think he adjusted the tax rate, and we ended up with a surplus. So I think the president is right on target, and I think a lot of people support him.
But, Wendy, do you he may be more for equity. Are you confident he can get economic growth with his package?
Well, I think that from what all I've read and heard with the economists, they say you've got to spend this money right now, and tax cuts are not spending, and we've got to put money back in to get something to make a shift with, you know, people to have more confidence.
Wendy, thanks very much. There's exactly the voice that got Barack Obama elected to the White House. And Wendy says, hey, he won. Of course, yes, Republicans pushing back this week. Here was Judd Gregg, New Hampshire Senator, Obama's former pick for Commerce Secretary, criticizing the president's budget plan.
The budget itself has got real serious problems, in my opinion, because it's a massive expansion in spending and a massive expansion in taxes. And the real problem is that in the out years, not only does it dramatically increase spending and taxes, but it passes on to our children a government that can't be afforded.
Can't be afforded. But here's former Arkansas governor and Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee cautioning Republicans to be careful on how they treat President Obama, even if they disagree.
We have to understand that there are many Americans, including conservatives, who personally like Barack Obama. And we need to be very careful that we don't create this sense of trying to demonize him or say ridiculous things and irrational things. We ought to have an honest, intellectually forthright discussion of the reasons that the policies are not the right way, and then offer suggestions.
But there was a lot of red meat this week, Liz Halloran, at the CPAC, Conservative Political Action Committee in Washington. Mike was saying, whoa, whoa, but there was plenty of high tone there.
Yes, this is one of the largest conservative organizations, and they had their annual meeting started on Thursday, continuing today. And they are obviously President Obama's budget gave them a lot of fodder for even former Governor Huckabee talked about Democrats edging toward socialism, or I'm paraphrasing, but something to that effect. So it's I think he's okay with criticizing congressional Democrats, but wants to be careful with the president. But they do have a tough situation now, and I think we were talking about Governor Jindal's performance before earlier in this program.
A lot of conservatives critical of it, not Rush Limbaugh, but others not too impressed.
Yeah, very critical of the message, this tax cut message, and basically what a lot of conservatives wanted more, him to be more articulate about what the party actually stands for. And they, in getting back to the caller, Wendy, who talked mm-hmm. about this is why we elected President Obama about this budget, mm-hmm. What he's been proposing is what he had campaigned on. And I was talking to someone yesterday who said if he doesn't take advantage of the goodwill that is coming from Wendy, and a lot of people, polls show a lot of support for him, he's got this Democratic Congress, and if he doesn't take advantage of it now, the question is what does he stand for? So he actually has some mandate from these people that I think that he will really attempt to leverage.
Clive, again, we'll look at some of the details, but on the big strategy of putting all these pins up on the table at once, how does that look to you? I mean, you know, if you look at how Congress has acted in recent years, it looks absolutely undoable. On the other hand, maybe there's some strategic advantage in getting everything in motion at once. Do you think it makes it more likely that the president can push through an agenda to have so many big planks in play at one time?
Well, I think it would be a big mistake to underestimate Obama. He's a man of extraordinary ambition, and he's obviously decided that he has to seize the moment. And I agree with the caller who just said, you know, there's nothing, he isn't proposing to do anything he didn't say he was going to do. I mean, the surprising thing about the budget is that it sticks so closely, actually, to the platform he outlined in the election. You know, we've got used to the idea that politicians say one thing to get elected and then another thing when they're in office. And Obama isn't doing that. So while I agree with that, but I do want to respond, to something Jack said before, which is really goes to the big picture question you're asking. I agree that I think Obama has announced that he wants to create, you know, a new kind of American economy. I mean, it's as big as that, you know. Mm-hmm. He's looking for an economy where the unions have a much bigger say to protect middle class earnings. You know, the Employee Free Choice Act is designed to do that. He's talking about higher taxes on the rich to provide a greatly expanded safety net and all kinds of programs, and in particular universal health care, that are in the public interest. Well, when you run down that list, what you get is a kind of European social contract, right? European public services and European levels of taxation and European levels of union involvement in the running of the economy. Now, my question really to Jack and to the American people is, mm-hmm. is that what you want? You know, despite my carefully cultivated American accent, you might suspect that I'm a foreigner.
Just a little.
Yeah, well, I'm a Brit, and, you know, I see the downside of the European formula very much. It's not all roses. The question is whether America can combine European taxation, European social safety net with, with the traditional American economic virtues.
What do you think, British cousin? Is that possible?
I'm skeptical. No, I don't think I don't think you can. I think if you choose the European model, if that's what this is about, you end up with all of it, the downside as well as the upside. And I wonder if that is actually what America is going to decide it wants.
Let's get listeners right on this point. Brian in Jay, New York. Brian, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to agree with that last speaker and object to what Jack Beatty had to say about his union
embrace, shall we say? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. I think that the thing that has killed the car industry in the United States is the unions. The companies that are successful are the Walmarts of the world, Microsofts of the world, the non-unionized companies. And I personally would not have a union shop. You know,
are you a business owner, or are you working
with unions?
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that Obama is successful in getting his health care through, because that would take a major part of union negotiations out of the mix.
Are you a business owner, Brian?
Yes, I am.
So that's interesting. You're rooting for universal health care to take away one of the union's selling points because you don't want them in your shop.
Well, I don't want to have to pay for it.
Yeah, yeah.
No. Not in union terms.
Hey, Jack, how about it? We are looking at the cost structure of the American auto industry, and it is pretty tough to be competitive on right now. Brian points to unions and said, there's why.
Well, that's one argument. Another argument would be that they simply missed the market, that they have put out substandard products. But, you know, if you take the long view, there mm-hmm. is a very frightening correlation, or at least stark correlation. In the 60s, 35% of the private sector workforce was unionized, and we had real incomes growing by 41% in the decade. Well, we know that over the last 7 years, they in fact declined, and unionization went beneath 10%. Now, is there a cause and effect between unionization and higher wages for Americans? I believe history says there is. Is that a price that private businesses don't want to pay? Of course so. But on the other side, and this is well documented in research out of Harvard and other places, the union worker is more productive on the whole than the non-union worker. That premium charged by the union wage results in higher productivity on the whole.
And so there is some general gain for unionization in terms of efficiency. But the efficiency argument has to yield at certain points to the equity argument. And the equity argument is itself an economic argument. People have to buy these products. They have to buy these cars. And one of the problems that's behind our whole subprime mortgage mess is the slow growth of wages. If people had enough money to live on, they wouldn't have had to take so many of these risky mortgages. And we might have been spared this disaster. So although you have people in favor of unionization, as I do, have to admit there's a efficiency cost. People on the other side have to recognize that there's also a necessity for people to have money to buy products, and that the efficiency costs of unions, I think, are made up for on the other side, on the demand side, by higher demand.
Liz Halloran, I wonder how you're hearing this. Clive Crook, our British cousin, looking at this and saying, are you headed, USA, toward a European social contract? Brian calling in from New York and saying, you know, please not in my shop. Do you sense in Washington, let's say on Capitol Hill, a sense that, yes, we are moving to a new model. We know it. We're going there. It's happening. Are people on board with that or still kind of feeling their way, Liz?
Well, I think that remains to be seen, but it's interesting to hear both Jack and Clive talk about this, because there certainly has been an erosion of the middle class, and some, maybe Jack would argue that, you know, part of that is due, obviously, to the decline in union membership and union representation. But there is this efficiency issue. The legacy costs have been devastating. The legacy benefits costs, the benefits that Ford and GM and the car companies pay, American car companies pay to their retirees, have been devastating. So, unions are terrible until you need them, and there is this battle that's going to play out big time on Capitol Hill over this union issue and how difficult Congress wants to make it or doesn't want to make it to join a union. And I think you'll see a lot of this shake out during those debates.
Let's get a call from Mary in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air.
Hello. I had a couple comments. I was a big supporter of Obama, and when he won, I said, I know he's going to do a great job. I just hope the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress don't blow it. And I think they are.
Why? How?
Well, I think there's a lot of hypocrisy in the Republicans' argument about all of a sudden being concerned about deficits and spending. However, I do think the leadership of the Democratic Party, particularly Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, are not the best that the Democratic Party has to offer.
Why? What's your complaint, Mary, about them?
I don't think they reach out enough. I think there's a little bit of, maybe unconsciously, a little bit of payback from the last 8 years. And it's always hard to know exactly what happened behind the scenes. But from what I've read, you know, many Republicans, they don't have a complaint about Obama and his reaching out. They do have a complaint because they don't feel they've been involved in the process. It was Nancy Pelosi's bill.
Mary, our time is short. Let us pick it up. Clive, is there room for outreach here? I mean, it's hard to expect Republicans to sort of roll over and go European social contract if that's what's on the table here. Do you see Pelosi and Reid as too high-handed? Is it possible to have the bipartisanship for this agenda that President Obama so compellingly asks for?
Well, first of all, you know, as the person who just called in said, there's a little bit of payback, I'd say, just a little bit of payback. I mean, of course, Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, I think that's what's mainly on their mind, you know.
Payback?
Yeah, payback, sure. And I think that they are extremists. But what I think is interesting about the budget is that because it's so radical, and so ambitious, I think it will alter the politics. You remember when we were debating the fiscal stimulus bill, I think Obama successfully portrayed himself as a centrist and a pragmatist and made the Republicans look to be, you know, knee-jerk rejectionists. Nothing will work. Nothing is any good. Now, I think that was a little unfair on the Republicans, because many Republicans did want to do a stimulus, but they had ideas about how to do it. But politically, Obama won that battle. I think in the country at large, he made the Republicans look like the rejectionists, the naysayers, while he was the centrist and the moderate. I'm not sure he's going to be able to maintain that posture now because of the budget, because the budget makes no concessions, I think, to centrist opinion. It is so so intent on piling all the costs of what he wants to do on the top 5%, I think it's going to be harder for him to maintain that posture of bipartisan outreach.
Of course,
and I think
that depends where the center is. If the center moves, I also can't help but think, I mean, it seems to me Obama still wants a market dynamic in here. It seems to me, when you read the body language in here, he seems to want to, maybe there's a new synthesis here of social welfare and market, but he doesn't seem to throw the market out with the bathwater. Well, yeah, maybe. Who
We've
knows?
We've heard that before. You know, we did the third way with Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, and it didn't really work out.
Yeah. Wow. Big numbers, big stuff on the table. And what a week. We didn't even get to that North Korea setting up on the launch pad over there and whether the U.S. may step in at some point and shoot it down. Liz, are they really serious about that?
I couldn't tell you.
Well, they're talking tough. We'll find out.
Tom, they're only putting up a weather satellite.
Oh, it's only weather. Okay, that's fine. And ours is in the drink, alas. Liz Halloran with NPR.org, Clive Crook, Financial Times et al., Jack Beatty, thanks to all of you for being with us. Listeners, thanks for joining. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.